Committee on Rules and Legislative and Administration will come to order. Members, we have a hearing later today on the House budget, and so what we're going to do is approve the calendar this morning so that we can get that started for the 24-hour rule, and then we will recess and reconvene later. So the first order of business this morning is the approval of the minutes of March 26th. Representative Furr moves approval of the minutes of March 26th. Any discussion? Seeing none, all those in favor, please say aye.
Aye.
No. The minutes are approved. Calendar for the day for April 1st, 2019. There are 1, 2, 3, 4, 5 bills on the calendar, and so a motion would be in order to approve the calendar subject to rules 1.21 and 3.33.
So moved.
Representative Olson moves the calendar for the day for April 1st. Any discussion? Seeing none, all those in favor, please say aye.
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 Say no. The motion fails. The calendar is approved for April 1st, and members were in recess. The Rules Committee will come back to order. I want to thank members for making time to be here today to discuss the House budget, and we're going to get some overview and then get into some of the specifics. And just so everyone is clear about how this works, we are basically today going to be considering whether to approve the recommendation from the controller, with whom I've worked and others have worked to come up with a budget proposal for the House, and that then will be sent over to the State Government Finance Committee to be included in its omnibus budget bill. So our mission is to consider whether this is a good recommendation to make to State Government Finance, and then State Government Finance will carry the funding for the House of Representatives in its budget bill. And so that's how it will roll out. And so I would like to first do an overview of the proposal, and then we will get to the point of having a motion after we've done the overview. And I think members, the way this is basically going to work is the House controller will present kind of at a high level. We will then get into a couple of individual testifiers about where we stand and why this proposal came forward. And as each of those testifiers comes forward, I think that would be a good time for questions. And so the other thing I would like to point, so we can get started, ask questions as we go along. I think the other thing to point out is that we're going to have a lot more open information about the House budget in this proposal than we have had historically, and that is not a comment on past speakers or majority leaders or either party, but we have a significant problem. And I think the problem that we face in our budget needs to be aired in public, and we need to acknowledge what the issue is and be more open going forward about how the House budget is managed. And it's driven by the fact that a major portion of our budget is not under our control anymore, and that is member salaries. And so that constitutional change to member salaries is why the House budget no longer can be reviewed and approved and done the way it has been in the past. And so that's the context for why we're having this hearing today, and I appreciate your attendance to learn about how this will work. So the first up to give us an intro is the House Controller, Barb Julek.
Mr. Chair, members, for the record, my name is Barb Julek, Controller for the House of Representatives. In your packet is a series of handouts relating to the budget. As the Majority Leader mentioned, I'm just going to give a very quick high-level review of what we're proposing, and we'll go into some details after some presentations and questions. From a high-level perspective, coming into the preparation for the 2021 budget, we are currently in 18 and 19 in about a $4.2 million operating deficit for the biennium. And this is completely tied to member increases that went in place 2 years ago. And so for the last 18, 20 months, we've been using our carry-forward funds to deal with that operating deficit. If we went into 20 and 21 with the same level of funding and the same level of budget, and then add on to the budget the proposed increases that are coming out of the Legislative Salary Council, which would add another $460,000 to that operating deficit. We would, at the end of the biennium, spend our carry forward down to about 2.3 million, but still have over a $2.4 million operating deficit. So we have about a three-year runway here to deal with this. That budget would not account for a number of things. It would not account for some end-of-life equipment. We have duplicating machines that are over 20 years old. We have end-of-life servers. We have a email system that is not the most prized email system from my understanding. We have end-of-life IT equipment, end-of-life furniture, just a number of things that need to address. You'll see we have a salary compensation study that points out we have an issue with our pay ranges. Keeping all things the same, we would not have addressed any of that and still be operating in an operating deficit, spending down our carry forward to about 2.3 million. So this budget proposal looks at all those end-of-life needs, looks at the Legislative Salary Council recommendations, looks at the salary study that you will be seeing in a second, and looks at some staffing issues that have come up over the past 2 years, and incorporates all that into a budget request that would increase our budget by about $10.1 million and ask for an appropriation increase of 11.5 so that we're not eating into our carry forward as much as we are today. It does request one-time spending in carry forward for our one-time replacement items, but fully funds our operating budget out of a general fund appropriation. And with that high-level overview, prior to going into details.
Ms. Julek, members, so we will get into the specifics of the proposed budget, but we are going to, so, and just if you could just tell us, if we don't increase the appropriation for the House and we otherwise keep things the same, when do we run out of money?
Mr. Chair, we would run out of money partially through the year fiscal 23. So we could make it through the next biennium, but we would spend down carry forward to close to $5 million over the biennium and have an operating biennial operating deficit of about $4.7 million going into the next biennium with a little over $2 million left to deal with that, having not addressed any other issues.
Right. Understood. Okay. So we'll get more into the details, but I think next I'd like to call up Diane Chaplin from NCSL. NCSL has conducted a staff compensation evaluation for the House, and Ms. Chaplin from NCSL will review the work that she did and the findings. So please identify yourself for the record and proceed with your presentation.
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, my name is Diane Chaffin. I'm Director of Operations at the National Conference of State Legislatures that oversees the administrative part of NCSL. I also work on salary and classification studies, having been my fourth salary and classification study in Minnesota. I did the Legislative Coordinating Commission, the Senate and the House in 2007. This is my second one in the House. I've done salary and compensation studies twice in South Dakota, Maine, North Carolina, and Louisiana. So I'd like to talk about what I was asked to do earlier this year in February of 2019. I was asked to look at the salary ranges in the House. Are these competitive with ranges that are seen out in the market? I was asked to look at certain positions. These are positions that are highly competitive positions, and say, are these positions in the right classification in the current salary range? Or when the ranges are brought to market, are they in the right classification then? And I was asked to look generally across the House at the compensation practices to see if there were recommendations that I would make moving forward. As I looked at the salary ranges, I found, looking at the counties in the Minneapolis-St. Paul area, the cities, going to the private sector Economic Research Institute, which looks at 8,000 positions over 1,000 different industries and averages that, I looked at Robert Half. I looked at a technology guide in the Minneapolis-St. Paul area. I looked at the Senate, the governor's office, the executive branch, and also the Legislative Coordinating Commission. And I found that the salaries for the House were 1 to 19% behind the market. And these are the salary ranges for positions. I found about 21 positions that are what I consider to be highly competitive positions. That is, when you classify these positions and you're hiring someone, you're looking for a high-level skill area, you're looking for high education, you are looking for independent judgment, you are looking for a big span of control, and probably the most important in these positions, there's a high consequence of error. And you'll find that in your IT positions, your accounting position, your human resource positions. You'll find this in your legal positions in the legislature and your fiscal positions. And it's that consequence of error that causes these positions to classify at a higher level. The salaries in the Minneapolis-St. Paul area, according to the Bureau of Labor Statistics, have risen 5.2% in 2018. That has not been true for the people in the House of Representatives. The salary increases outpace Chicago at 3.2%, LA, New York at 3.7%, Phoenix, and other major metropolitan areas. This is the highest concentration increase in salaries in the Midwest, is right here where you are. The unemployment is at 2.8%. This makes it very difficult to find skilled people. You've got to think of what is your compensation philosophy here. Is it, do you want to lag the market? Because that will affect the type of people that you find and you hire into the House. Do you want to be at market or do you want to be above market? I think you'll find the private sector, there are some places that's definitely above market. I would argue that the House needs to be at market. And currently you're not. In 2006, I came in and made recommendations for market ranges. You moved to market ranges in 2007. The economy fell out. Raises weren't given to staff. Ranges weren't moved. Salary ranges have not been moved since 2015. And I think most of you can see out in your communities that salaries are moving fast. Positions and communications have changed radically in the past 3 or 4 years in the communications area. We also have human resources, especially in the legislative environment. That's a key position. That's a key position. And most states that have faced legal challenges in the HR area will tell you you need people that are more and more sophisticated there. IT is moving fast. You need strong people there. And accounting will always be a high-demand profession. The 21 classification adjustments you can see from pages 6 through 9 in your study, they're the positions in red. They're the communications position, the Director of Public Affairs, Communications, Public Affairs, IT, Legislative Analysts, House Research, Fiscal Services, especially with the creation of the Legislative Budget Office. We found that the salaries there were at least 15 to 19% higher than the salaries that you, the ranges you currently have in the House. That was really critical to look at these other parts of the legislature and say, everybody seems to be going a different direction. One of the recommendations that I make down the road is that there be more communication. I made this in 2006. It hasn't happened, but there needs to be more communication. You end up with an arms race, and this is what concerns me with salaries, that it's really easy to end up in this position, and it's not something where, a place where you want to be, where people are poaching employees, especially within the legislature. Legislators, you lose one-third of your members every 2 years. So the legislature can turn over completely in the span of 6 years. The legislative institution needs to be strong, and where you find that strength is in your staff, the people that can help you, the people who can guide you, the people that can take care of the work that you need done. And I would argue that you need to move these ranges. There were some observations that I made in doing this study. The first was the House and Senate and Legislative Coordinating Commission working together. The second is there needs to be a process for the House to keep these ranges current. You should be looking at these ranges, generally all of them every 5 years. You should be watching these highly competitive positions every 2 years. You have a number of people who are now able to leave, who have met their retirement. You're losing some of the baby boomers. You've got millennials coming on. You've got younger people coming on. They don't want to wait to be promoted after 4 years to a higher level position. You need to look at how often you promote people, and you need to reward the high performing people by moving them up every 2 years, especially those that are of millennial age. This is going to be really important to keep people active and interested in the House. There needs to be some kind of an equity adjustment for current employees. If you move the salary ranges and you hire people in at this new market salary, you have people that are currently not even paid market salary. If you move them up to the bottom of the market salary range, you have a lot of compression. You're going to have to figure out how to deal with that. And I'm not going to get in the middle of what is a budget discussion for you all on how you deal with that compression. And you should also look at higher levels in job families. I get very nervous when people start creating positions to give people a promotion. It makes me very, very nervous. I like to see people have new jobs, different jobs that merit a promotion to a higher level. I know some of that goes on in the legislature. It goes on in every legislature, but I would caution against doing that. It seems that you have a number of promotional levels when the organization, and I think it's fine the way it is. But as you move forward, you really need to pay attention to where you hire people in attracting the best talent that you need for the legislature. Thank you.
Questions, members, about the study? Representative Carlson.
Mr. Chairman, I wonder if you could expand on your first observation in terms of how some other states have a process to keep abreast of what the salary and fringe benefits should be.
Ms. Chapman.
And then I have a separate follow-up question, if I could.
Absolutely. When NCSL has gone into states and done salary studies, and I have just done maybe six states. There are my colleagues who also do other states. And usually that gets implemented right away, and then adjustments are made every 5 years. You don't need NCSL to come in to do this because you can do it on your own. We'll give you the comparable positions, and you can do that yourself. But when you go through what Minnesota has gone through in its time, and that is the economy dropping out. I came in 2007, the economy drops out in 8, 9, 10, then you don't have raises, you don't even have a merit pool. It's very difficult to even look at updating salaries during that period of time. I would say if the economy stays constant, you should be looking at this. You should use part of your merit pool or cost of living. Some people do build a range adjustment into a merit pool, you can do that too, to keep the salary ranges moving every 2 years.
I think what I was referring to was more what kind of a process do they typically do it through, as we currently do it, through the Rules Committee, or do they have a separate committee that deals with compensation? And, Mr. Chairman, the reason I asked that question years ago, we had a subcommittee of the Rules Committee that dealt with employee relations. Both caucuses currently have a personnel committee, but that really deals more with the hiring side. And when you start talking about compensation, that's then been held in the Rules Committee and or, if you look at it back a number of years ago. In fact, at one point a number of years ago, we had an NCSL study then as well. But we did have a subcommittee of this committee that kept abreast of employee salaries and compensation for the entire House, which is different than the two caucus committees that we have. So that's what I was referring to in terms of how other states may keep abreast of right. The other issues that you just outlined.
Representative Carlson, they do it both ways. And they also do it like Minnesota with the special subcommittee. So there are the two ways that they do it.
And then, Representative Carlson, I said I had an unrelated to that question, but when I looked at the charts and so on you have here, when we're dealing with our state agencies and so on, and we're dealing with increasing FTEs or whatever, we talk total compensation, salary and fringe benefits. And if you'd care to comment about where we stand when we look at total compensation relative to your report.
Ms. Chaffin.
So I did not focus that much on total compensation, but I did look at some Bureau of Labor Statistics. I looked at some Minnesota Taxpayers Association. I know they have a new name now, but I looked at some of their studies. I think that, and we talked this morning about that, I think your benefits are about 33% of salary right now, and that is pretty average.
And Mr. Chairman, that's a rough percentage often when we're talking about increases in FTEs for various state agencies when we apply, you know, what the salary would be plus fringe benefits. We use roughly that kind of a percentage. Thank you.
Representative Druskowski.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. One question I had, and it's Ms.
Chaffin.
Chaffin?
Chaffin.
Chaffin, thank
yes.
you. You talked about the 2006 studies and kind of what the trends were since then. Of course, when we look at government salaries, they never go down. In the private sector, they do, and they did. So my question would be, how did you value what happened from 2008 through 2012 in the private sector, and how did these compensation ranges in these government positions compare during that time period, and how do they now? It seems to me, as you go through recession, the private sector finds that, at least they did from 2008 to 2012, a major reduction. We had employers cutting full benefit packages and getting rid of staff and in order to stay alive and reducing salaries, etc. That doesn't happen in government. It didn't here. I've never seen it happen. So it's interesting when the private sector now in the last 2 years is starting to regain its traction and actually starting to come up. We have government saying, well, we want to be part of that too, but it doesn't happen at the other end. So I'd be interested in your comments around that, kind of the cyclical curve of the private sector. Obviously, there's a gradual increase over time, but there's also cyclical nature based on the economy. Government doesn't follow that, so Why should we follow that in an up economy in the private sector, but not in a down economy in a recession?
Okay.
Ms. Chaffin.
Yes. So I can tell you that these salary ranges haven't moved at all since 2015. You are hiring at the same level that you did in 2015, the beginning salaries. So the beginning salaries have not changed at all. Unfortunately, the House moves the salary ranges with the cost of living adjustment. There has not been a cost of living adjustment, with the exception of the last year, for a number of years. So there's been no movement in the salary ranges. So when you go out to market and you're trying to hire someone, you're hiring the HR director, for example. The private sector is hiring at 97,000 and you're hiring at $70,000, which doesn't necessarily get you the best HR director that you need, especially in this day and age of Me Too. So I would argue that you haven't had a mechanism for moving the ranges. You're keeping the bottom the same. The private sector can move the ranges. We also talked this morning about the number of positions that have been in the House, and I think Kelly Knight is going to follow me, but there's been a dramatic drop in the number of positions that you've had in the House, in the number of positions that have been funded. So I think it'll be interesting when you look at that. You know, we talk about the private sector expanding, contracting, whatever. The same thing has happened here. I just don't think it's been broadly, you know, brought to people's attention.
So, and Representative Joskowski, just to interject. So Ms. Chaffin was tasked with looking at where we stand today, and Ms. Knight will come forward and talk about something, you know, what has happened over the last 8 to 10 years. So to the extent you're looking for history, she may be able to be more helpful. Representative Howard.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. my question did the study look at some of the impacts, or just from your experience, what could you tell us about some of the impacts of being out of range with other agencies or the nonprofit or private sector for some of these positions?
Well, absolutely, there is an impact from being out of range. You don't necessarily attract the best qualified people. Your positions stay a little open, stay open for longer. The turnover in 2018 here was 15.5% turnover in employees, and in 2017 it was 18% in turnover. I think you've lost some really good people in the fiscal area, and that's had an impact. I even saw articles outside the legislature about the loss of these people and what it means to the organization. So I think when you start losing people that are high performing, there's a big impact from not keeping pace with market.
Representative Howard.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And then just to comment, and I kind of have a unique perspective on this as someone who has been a House staff person and been in a role where we're looking to retain and hire quality staff here in the House. And over my time over the past several years, including some of the downturn time, you know, I really did see a huge challenge with retaining our workforce, some of the best workers we had and skilled workers in the House. We are always in competition with other state agencies, with the federal government, with the Senate. And we've never really lined up well, and I think especially over the last several years where we've seen just flat, that challenge is growing. And so I really applaud the study here and the work. I think it's really important. And then just one last comment. I mean, I think at the legislature, members are pretty good about thanking our staff, but sometimes it feels to me like that thank you is about us as members feeling good about thanking our staffs, and we should be a little better about putting our words into action and showing our gratitude in our budget and putting our money where our mouth is. And that's why it's important, I think, we take a look at this and try to raise up our level and make sure that we're respecting our great staff and, you know, putting our money where our mouth is.
Thank you. Representative New.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Ms. Chafin, thank you so much for your presentation. I just have a few questions. One, since we just talked about the turnover, can you give us some indication? You said there's 15% turnover one year, 18% another. How does that compare to the different organizations you're comparing to, the private sector, the Senate, the executive, et cetera?
Well, in my opinion, I think you've been really lucky. And we talked up in your office earlier today, you know, when I look at turnover, I think, woo, those are the people we're really glad they left. So you take that 15% and then that knocks it down to maybe 10, and I'm being hypothetical here. And then you have the people who have retired, and you knew that was coming and it was absolutely expected. It's what you really care about are the people that are the top performers. And when they go elsewhere because they can get more money, then that's a blow to the legislative institution. And I'm going to let Kelly talk a little bit about that because I can't talk about specific people here in the House. So,
Ms. Representative New.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So do you have an idea of what a typical turnover is in a private sector company or the Senate, how that compares?
No, I don't know what it is in the Senate, and I think in the private sector it really varies as far as the type of company. I think that Google probably doesn't have a lot of turnover, and or maybe they do. But the better you pay, the more energetic the industry, the less turnover you have.
Okay.
But I can't tell you specifically about that. I will tell you NCSL's turnover is in the 30% range.
Thank you.
Representative New.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Sort of a related question, I suppose. Is there anything in the methodology of the study, particularly when it compares to the private sector? Because certainly the executive branch, the Senate, would have similar circumstances. Is there anything in the methodology in these to account for sort of the very unique nature of the legislature and some of those things that might be more intangible? So, for example, you know, our salaries clearly are a little bit low for many of these categories, but there are sort of intangible benefits. They work really hard for several months, but they get some time off when other people might not be getting time off and things like that. Is there anything in the methodology to account for things like that? And perhaps that maybe leads to, I mean, it sounds like this 15 to 18% might actually be relatively low. Is there anything to account for things like that?
You know, this is why we go to the Economic Research Institute to get our figures, because they average the private sector. And I think I've never felt that it makes sense to go to law firms in the city where the state capital is, or to go to big city law firms and to ask what their salaries are, because it is so skewed. And I think that when you average the private sector and you're looking at small firms with large firms and you average that together, you get a more realistic figure where you can compare the midpoint that ERI finds, the average midpoint that they find, with the midpoint in the legislature, and it makes a lot more sense to do that. So that's why when I came in 2007, I went to the public service, you know, I went to some of the big corporations around here and got figures. And then as we looked over it, we said it probably makes a lot more sense to average this. We also averaged the midpoints of all the public sector employers too, so that we're not skewing to a county that seems to pay a lot of money over another county that doesn't. So we tend to average those, and then we look at the average midpoints with the midpoint of the House in making that determination.
Representative New.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. That actually would be interesting data to see. I mean, do you have this broken down further, taking out the private sector and comparing, which would be maybe a more direct comparison to the executive branch, to the Senate? Do you have those comparisons broken down?
Yes,
I do. That would be interesting to see. And in addition, and perhaps this would be a question more for Mrs. Knight, I'm not sure, but do you know, given the different, the breakdown in positions, do we know what the net effect would be in the short term? How many of these positions, how many people would be bumping up salaries immediately and in the different categories?
Right. I don't know that, but Kelly Knight does. I tend to stay, when I do these studies, I stay away from individual people. I stay away from individual skills that they bring to the positions. I deal with this more as a group. And you always, when you do a salary study, have to separate out the employee from the actual position when you're looking at market.
Representative New.
One more question. Thank you, Mr. Chair. And my last question for now, you know, we discussed this idea that, you know, government does not decrease. As you mentioned, certainly we have decreased by attrition. We went over those numbers. We're actually down significantly from FTEs from a number of years ago. Can you dig into a little bit as well what happens with what our total budget is when we exchange majorities? Because it seems like, you know, I mean, so for example, the House Republicans had a majority for two biennium. So presumably we would have quite a few people from one biennium to the next bumping up their salaries, whereas now we have a new majority. There are a lot of new employees coming in who would now be at the lower end of that. So presumably the budget would actually be a little bit less than it was. Does that make sense, that question? Is that
yes,
clear?
I think it does. And once again, I didn't go into the salaries. I leave that to your budget experts and the HR department.
And Representative New, we'll have a chance to look both at the trends with Ms. Knight and Ms. Julek in their following presentations.
Great.
So this is, members, try to focus on just this study as much as possible in the questions. Representative Lilly.
Sorry, Mr. Chair. Thank you very much for the study. I always find these very interesting, and you know, at times I suppose they're hard for some people to see the numbers, but to hear the competitiveness of you know, trying to keep people, I mean, really is the bottom line. I don't know what to say, because I guess I'm gonna just talk. So, and then you can gavel me down. You know, we all value the nonpartisan staff and talk about them, and, you know, certainly Pat McCormick's team and all those people, and then the chief clerk's team, and, you know, the nonpartisan folks, and we all look at the partisan staff around here, and you know, I actually value these goofballs over here even, and our team, but you know, they're but it's, and the people that also keep the whole building clean and safe, you know, so, and we've really seen a great improvement in the safety of this building. But you know, I'm one of those that listens, you know, Representative Howard kind of alluded to this. You know, I'm one of those that likes to listen to the retirement speeches, and we really do thank people. Everyone does it, both sides of the aisle. Even Representative Drazkowski will do it when he decides to go home, I'm hoping. I hope you do, because I know they help you as well. But, you know, sometimes thank yous aren't enough, like Representative Howard talks about. So these studies are really valid, and we want to keep good people, and part of that's paying them well, you know, and that's the reality. So anyways, thank you. Sorry, Mr. Chair.
Representative Baker.
Mr. Chair, some of these I think maybe I can maybe wait until Ms. Knight comes up. Just a question, where does the revisor's office fall? Is that under our purview? I don't see their items listed here.
Representative Baker, that falls under the Legislative Coordinating Commission, which is a, essentially it's a committee run by equal members of the House and Senate. And so that is going through a similar budget review process right now.
Got it. Okay, that's all I have for now.
Okay. Representative Herr.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And I just maybe wanted to add just a quick comment around the data, too, that I know we've had a lot of discussion around, like, what the private sector is doing, what we do. And I just want us to be really thoughtful about maybe the nuances of the data, because the private sector didn't actually reduce people's wages. What they did was they went through and decided they were going to hire a bunch of temp employees to do permanent people's jobs who they never rehired back. They are shifting from asking, like my husband went through a big reorganization, they call them reorganization, where they make people reapply for their jobs and then they don't hire them back because they're going to hire somebody who has less experience, who doesn't who won't cost them as much. And so if we're looking at average salaries, to not think of it as, well, the private sector just reduced people's salaries. They don't do that. Nobody does that. Because if you can't tell somebody that we're in a tough time, now you're going to take a $10,000 cut. It almost never happens. And so I want us to be thoughtful about the nuances, and that when you look at the average private sector salary, it might have gone down, but it wasn't because they were reducing individual salaries. They were actually doing some pretty interesting things within their own industries to keep salaries down. And so I just want us to think about the nuances as we're looking at the data, because we don't have equal comparisons. Because we are such a unique body, that the averages are the best that might be able to happen within these this scenario and these situations. And so those would be great if we did have something comparable, to just remember the nuances of that we're not really comparing apples to apples, and we're using it to actually as a guide and looking at our own historical data, and if we've been able to keep up with inflation, and if we've made cost of living adjustments and things like that, that's probably a more accurate, because what we're seeing now in the private sector is that they have been making cost of living adjustment, and with the market being so tight in the labor market, it's really difficult to hire people unless you pay them more money now. And so just to kind of keep those things in mind as we're looking at the data, the historical data, and also the averages that we're sort of comparing here.
Representative Druskowski, I think you wanted to respond, but I'll go to Representative Becker Finn first and then return to you.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And one point I wanted to make, and I share a lot of the comments of Representative Howard, as a former staff person who was hired under the minimum, which was a thing at one point. But the thing I wanted to point out is, you know, as we compare things to the private sector, we have to keep in mind, too, that even if we paid, even if we kept up with the private market, there are some unique drawbacks for folks who choose to work here. And, you know, so even if you're getting paid the same as you would in the private sector, I think sometimes we take for granted, you know, that when we're here till midnight, you know, we chose to run for office, but the staff are really at the whim of the body as far as how long they're working. I know, you know, I certainly get emails from staff people who are sending out emails and still working at 2 a.m. To make sure that we have the information that we need and that everybody's up to date. So I just wanted to point out that it is kind of hard to make some of the direct comparisons because, you know, we have staff who might not really see their families for 2 months at a time when we're here round the clock. And that's, you know, I can choose to bring my kids here occasionally, but our staff doesn't always have that, I guess, luxury of having your kid tag along while you're trying to do your work. But I think that's an important piece to this as we look about what a fair way to pay the staff here is, because there really are, as you're weighing the pros and cons, are you going to take the job that pays the same but you don't have to maybe be there around the clock? Are you going to take the private sector job where maybe the hours are a little bit more reasonable? So I just wanted to make that point in addition to echoing the comments of Representative Howard.
And Representative Druskowski.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And by the way, Representative Becker Finn, I largely agree with what you said. I think we need to look at wages that are fair and that that make sense, not ones that are overly generous either, because unfortunately in government we do that folks a lot of the time. And Representative Herr, you're wrong. There are many businesses in Minnesota that actually cut actual compensation during the recession from 2008 to 2009. If you would like, I can go in my district and find at least a half a dozen or more that I talked to back then, and I bet I can go in your district and find a bunch too. Not only did they cut compensation, some of them cut full benefit packages, and some of them cut employees, but many of them cut compensation in order to keep their employees, in order to keep their employees and their families afloat during that time, and looking out for their best interests as well, because that's what the people in the private sector do. We often forget, as we become insulated here in government, that the government doesn't have to look at the revenue end and make it match the other end. Instead, what the government does is simply goes out and takes more revenue when they need it. And unfortunately, I'm really frustrated that sometimes we become insulated here and forget that. So it's important for us to have that perspective. But, Mr. Chair, if I could, I had actually had a question before Representative Herr brought up those things challenging my assertion. So could I ask that, Mr. Chair?
Representative Drazkowski, yes.
Okay. Thank you. The Economic Research Institute, can you tell us more about them? The only thing I know, and I was trying to look on Google about them, and as Representative New mentioned, I would like to actually see some of the granular data that you have in your study from the private sector, because all I remember about the Economic Research Institute, and we do want this to be a nonpartisan exploratory mission into this, is their opposition to some of the labor stuff that I've done in the past. They're not a right-to-work organization, let me say that. I know that very clearly. But if you can tell me more about them and what they do and their ability to be nonpartisan, and that would be helpful.
Right, yes. We don't look at that with ERI. We don't look at what their political stance is. We just know that they have good data on private sector and its average data. They also have great salary assessor tools that we have used to take when we did the Senate. We looked at the Secretary of the Senate salary, and we went out to about 5 to 7 states and then plotted that using market data for St. Paul to reduce the salary and to get it comparable to what kind of a salary you might find in St. Paul. So we've used their salary assessors, we've used their salary data, and would you like me to get you those figures? I can do that. Okay, absolutely, I will.
Representative Drazkowski, I wonder if you're thinking of the Economic Policy Institute.
Maybe that's it, Mr. Chair.
And that would
comply
entirely with your characterization.
If you know them well, Mr. Chair, I think you're right.
I do know them well, Representative Drazkowski.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Very well. Representative Carlson.
Mr. Chair, I think I was going to give a little history lesson, but I think I'll wait until Ms. Kelly gives her history lesson, because I think there have been a number of statements that have been made by at least one member of the committee that are grossly inaccurate in terms of the history of salaries and fringe benefits during downtimes in the Minnesota legislature.
Okay. Well, thank you, Ms. Chaffin, for your study and for bringing this forward. We're going to ask Ms. Knight to come forward now
and give us a little bit of
House-specific history. Please identify yourself for the record and proceed.
Mr. Chair and members, my name is Kelly Knight. I'm the Director of Human Resources for the Minnesota House of Representatives. Some of the information that you have in your packet that we thought would be helpful is kind of a history of staffing. For sure during my tenure here, to give people an idea, it's the larger charts. The first one being the green chart, and that is a representation of our permanent employee FTEs, our full-time equivalents, and this will show you that history from 1997 to current and how we were at a high in January of 2002 of 280.4 FTEs, and we are currently at 231.85 FTEs. You'll see some sharp declines during recessionary periods. Also, too, in the temporary employee complement, you'll see a high in January of 2001 of 92 session-only staff to our current 60 session-only staff.
So, members, that's just background on the number of staff here, and I think it's important that we not have a perception that the compensation study is reflecting also a significant increase in staff complement. Ms. Knight, did you have anything further?
Yes, Mr. Chair, members, one of the things I know Ms. Chaffin mentioned that she was here and did the study in 2007. And in 2007, at that time, the study found that our salary ranges were low, and that was anywhere from 4 to 16%, and that competitive position salary ranges needed to also be adjusted. Also a recommendation that the House salary ranges be moved annually at a rate equal to the cost of living, and that, again, we review our salary ranges against market data every 5 years and then possibly every 2 years for some highly competitive positions. And the House, immediately after this survey came through and was presented, was not able to do the recommendations because of the 2008 recession. And then that was followed by 5 years of zero pay increases, and while the executive branch agencies continued to receive pay increases, which further caused us to have complicating factors and the agencies to be able to take our people. In addition, now, one of the things that we're seeing are those higher salary ranges in the Senate, the executive branch, and in the LBO in particular, which would allow our staff to move to a higher compensated position and remain within the state of Minnesota. So maintain their tenure, maintain their benefits or vacation and everything. And my concern is when you have that within the agencies taking our staff, and in addition to that, we're getting to a point where we have a lot of senior staff that are retiring. I'm concerned about the brain drain on the institution.
Right, Representative Baker.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Ms. Kelly, or Ms. Knight, you know, having had just had a chance to work with you on a personnel committee, when we went through the changes, and as an employer myself, it was really helpful for me to work through that process. And with your knowledge about the depth of your tenure here, I do see a need to make sure that we come up with a system. Maybe it's part of the House rules. Maybe it's through a different arm or whoever is doing these things. But again, I think when we are going right through the hiring, or in our case this year is actually releasing some employees, which is hard to do when you go from the majority to the minority, you sure are plugged into the market and to what's needed, and are we offering the right kind of packages? Have you seen in your tenure then here where, again, personnel committees on both sides of the aisle get together and it's kind of set in stone? At least if we get together once or twice at the beginning of the year to sort of talk about whoever, who's ever in charge doesn't matter. What matters is that our personnel committees are lining up to say, are we lining up? And it's a kind of a forced conversation. Is that happening, or has it happened in the tenure in the past? Just so our rates are staying competitive, or at least we're looking at the studies, or because I see what I'm hearing is things kind of get put on and they get forgotten about and you move along and things get forgotten. But what have you seen in the past year?
Ms. Knight.
Mr. Chair and members, I think that there is, within the House, there is an equity, between caucuses, between the nonpartisan offices and the caucuses. So there's an equity there where we get blindsided is when the executive branch all of a sudden increases, and I know that they have requested money to do a further salary study, which could put even more pressure on this if that outcome shows that they're below market. And there's very little coordination there. And, you know, that's one of the things that we had hoped to do was to, as Ms. Chaffin had talked about, look at this and do this every 5 years. But it's hard to wade into that and to go, well, I just want to let you know that everybody is 10% below market when there's no money for pay increase. So that was one of the reasons that some of this had gotten pushed off.
Well, and Ms. Knight and Representative Baker, I think the point being that you have ranges that you work with in your department for compensation for employees, which are reflective of the budget available to total budget for paying the staff complement.
Correct.
And to that, Mr. Chair, I guess, so your colleague over in the Senate and maybe your colleague elsewhere, because this environment is very unique. I mean, as we've said, you know, we're full on in 100 hours a week for our staff, but they do get time off in the summer that's comp time, and I think that's a nice benefit to have because they want to be where the action is. So this is not like a private sector job. They love being here, and I think that part of this is I just think we need to make sure that we know what our competition, in this case it's the executive branch and the Senate, so when they're moving and adjusting, we at least need to know about it, and I don't know what that mechanism is to do that, if it's through your office and if you know what they're doing. I just want to make sure that whether we are going to move or not, we at least need to know if others are moving, we need to know when they're doing it because those are competing for the same staff.
Ms. Knight.
Mr. Chair, members, yes, and we can do that and then, you know, bring that data back here to this committee. I would also argue that our pool gets even smaller because of the hours during session. We've lost staff that can't work till 3 a.m. because there's not daycare till 3 a.m. Yeah. And so they, even though they love this place and agreed they love serving the members, they love being here, they can't. I mean, they just can't do it. So then that pool of knowledge or that pool that we have access to becomes smaller, while an agency that doesn't have that same demand might have access. That'd be a good fit for that person.
Thank you.
Representative Becker Finn.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And Ms. Knight, I'm wondering if you could, this kind of segues well with the questions from Representative Baker. Do the temporary employees qualify for comp time or overtime pay?
Ms. Knight.
Mr. Chair and members, they do not. The temporary staff are limited to the hours in the pay period. So if the pay period's 80 hours, they're limited to 80 hours. They may work 10 hours one day, but work 6 hours the next. So they are limited to the hours in the pay period.
Representative Becker Finn.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I mean, do we know, are we monitoring that closely so that during the crunch times we don't have people who are, you know, so we don't have a wage theft situation here where we've got people working kind of off the clock.
Ms. Knight.
Mr. Chair, members, yes. Supervisors will tell you that they receive weekly, if not per pay period, calls from my office. And if somebody is 15 minutes over on a time card, there's a phone call. So, and they get reports after each pay period. So they know exactly. And the supervisors have to sign off on those time cards. So even if they let something go through and it shows up as 80.25 and it should have only been 80, they've got a phone call from my office on that. So supervisors have been amazingly compliant with that, yes.
Representative Becker-Finn.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And so then could you talk about the comp time, what those calculations are and the minimums, maximums, you know, because if we're going to talk about comp time as if it's some, like, golden thing that makes working 100 hours a week all worth it, if you just explain that a little bit further.
Yeah, and Mr. Chair and members, this committee actually just adopted a change to the comp time policy, and in a pay period, staff are required to work 4 hours over whatever the hours in the pay period are. So if the hours in the pay period happen to be 80, they would work 84 hours. For every hour that they work over that, they get an hour of comp time. I will tell you that we've had several staff that maxed out at comp time at the end of February. And the max on comp time is 220 hours.
Representative Becker-Finn.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So, like, as of right now, how many House staff are already maxed out of comp time?
Ms. Knight.
Mr. Chair and members, I don't have an answer to that, but it's, I would say there are going to be a number that will be as of the end of March, and we could look at that and certainly let you know what that is.
Thank you.
Representative New.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And to my previous question, I'm wondering, Ms. Knight, if you can give us some idea, some indication of what this would look like in these individual categories. You don't need to go through each one, but some indication of maybe where we are currently, of how many employees are at that introductory base salary. So we have some idea of how many salaries will immediately bump up. Do you have some idea of what we're looking at for that?
Yeah.
Ms. Knight.
Mr. Chair and members, we have, if the range adjustments, if the committee accepted these new ranges, there would be 96 employees who would need to be brought up to the new minimum.
Representative New.
Thank you. And Ms. Knight, that's out of 233 employees?
233 bodies, 231.85 FTEs.
So close to half. Close to half. Okay. Thank you.
Representative Carlson.
Yeah, Mr. Chairman, just to add a little bit to what Ms. Knight covered, I referenced earlier the history. And we've responded in a variety of ways over the years during economic downturns. And as she's pointed out, you know, some of the things have been like a salary freeze, hiring freezes. I remember when each caucus was asked to reduce their costs. And I don't recall at that time how the Republican caucus handled it, but we were all given a number. In the case of the DFL caucus, rather than laying people off, our staff voluntarily took a salary reduction, and by doing so, it avoided any layoffs. And I don't know how the other side of the aisle did it, because we each had a fair amount of latitude when we were doing that as long as we met the budget target. And so I just want to point out, because of the comments where it made it sound like government employees sometimes don't suffer during economic downturns, they certainly do. And it's true with the Minnesota House of Representatives as well. And by the way, when I referenced having a subcommittee of rules dealing with personnel matters, seeing Ms. Kelly at the table, one of the recommendations that we made at the time was to have a personnel director. We didn't have one prior to that, and I would say at that point in time one of our good decisions. And thank you for your work.
Thank you.
So, members, we have 15 minutes left, and we're going to hear from Mr. McCormick and Mr. Marks about the challenges in fiscal and research in maintaining employees with these salary ranges. This is just one component of the House budget. So based on the time that we have taken on the staff salary issue and the fact that we have a visitor here, I think it's time well spent, but we will have to come back at some point in the next week or so to review the rest of the House budget and take a look at what these numbers mean. I will give you a quick highlight, and that is that this is in your packets, but if you look at the budget summary, essentially the cost to implement the recommendations from the compensation study is about the same as the cost to pay members for our salary increase through the compensation commission. So there is rough parity there. It's not exact, but it's rough. And so as we come back to think about the budget down the line, we are essentially asking the members of the House to approve a House budget that would increase parity for staff in line with the same dollar amount that members received. So that's just an FYI. And so now I would like Mr. McCormick and Mr. Marks to come forward.
Mr. Chair, members,
Mr. McCormick,
Patrick McCormick, Director of House Research. In thinking about my very brief comments here today, I thought I'd ask myself the question, what is the relative advantage that staff gives the House of Representatives? And we work with state agencies all the time, and state agencies are great. They're large bureaucracies, they have large staffs, they have a lot more formal procedures, institutional data, practical program knowledge, and so we rely on state agencies as we budget for them. The legislature uniquely relies on the institutional memory and knowledge of its staff. And it's crucial to understand what we've gone through. We have gone through and are going through the departure of the baby boom. People like Joel Michael, Mark Shepard, Kathy Novak, and my shop, who, when they walk out the door, take 35 or 40 years of knowledge. We brought some great people in. They're smarter than I am. They're tougher than I am. If we lose those people partway through their development process, that crimps the legislature's ability to craft good legislation. And I want to say that this insight applies to all of the staff. It applies to the partisan staff who we work with and rely on, the LCC staff, the desk staff, the IT, the support staff. And if I leave somebody out, the chief clerk will tell me who I left out. People from the LCC, people from all walks of life, even the Senate staff. By the way, I used to be a Senate staffer, and I'm going to check out the salaries because I could always go back there and get a little raise if I were virtual Senate. I'll talk to Tom later. Right now, I think the House staff are significantly impacted, and the NCSL does show that. When parallel positions in county government, university government, state government, nonprofits, private sector are paying more, sometimes with more generous benefits, hiring retention becomes an issue,
And that issue impacts our ability to have the institutional knowledge to bring forward the facts that make this place run. So it's about building the staff resilience, which is our unique advantage compared to the large, wonderful bureaucracies out there that we interact with daily.
Marks. Mr. Chair, members, just kind of building on what Mr. McCormick said, as far as a fiscal staff, we're relatively small, 11 staff. Over the recent years, we've evolved. We've had some retirements. We've also lost some people. We lose people, some people who don't care for the legislative environment or the time demands are too great. We've also lost some people because of salaries, and that's the area where I hate to see us losing people, because when we lose good people because another state agency or somebody else can pay them more, that's the part that I feel like we're losing an opportunity there. So we know that the executive branch, in particular Department of Finance staff, who we work closely with and who are comparable to kind of our job positions, we know that we've fallen behind a little bit on where their salary schedules are, and that's of concern. So all in all, I think the recommendations would help. They'd help us keep us on a competitive level as far as salaries, and help us keep what I think are a good staff that we have. So.
Questions from members? Thank you very much. All right, so Representative Schultz.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I just want to address a comment that was made earlier. I think that members should refrain from saying a member is wrong. I think that's not very civil, and in this case wasn't true. So one of my fields of education was labor economics. I spent many years at the Federal Reserve Bank studying labor economics, looking at compensation and wage data for large, medium, and small firms. And what Representative Hare said is exactly correct. It is very rare that you see wages fall. Labor economists call that sticky wages, sticky downward, that wages rarely fall, but compensation, total compensation may fall because they're reducing medical benefits or they're passing on the costs of benefits to the employee. But most often, they're changing from full-time to part-time employees. So I don't think Drazkowski is wrong either. There could be smaller firms, very small employers, that do ask their employees to take a pay cut temporarily, but that's very rare. When you look broadly nationally at many more firms, you very rarely see a wage drop.
Thank you. Ms. Julek, why don't you get started? We can go over a little bit, but I think the challenge of going through the whole House budget in the next 5 minutes is pretty great, so I think we'll have to find another time.
Mr. Chair, I think I've done HHS in 5 minutes, so we'll see what I can do. As a former Senate staffer.
Ms. Julek, we don't want to start comparing to what can happen at the legislature. We are starting with what should happen at the legislature.
All right, Mr. Chair and members, as mentioned earlier, and I think I need to correct a statement, we started this budget review process looking at where we are in 18 and 19 and our current operating deficit, and if we continued that pattern and not address any of staffing issues or end-of-life IT capital investment issues, we would run out of money in fiscal 22. I think I said 23, but it's 22, so the first year of the following biennium. This budget did take, as a starting point, 18 and 19. One of the things to address Representative New's question, specifically in salary, what we were able to do in starting and looking at that with the transition, our starting point of salary did drop compared to 2 years ago. And that savings allowed me, kind of in the base budget, to absorb increases in healthcare, increases in IT maintenance contracts and IT software licensing contracts, increases in other little trends You know, the gas mileage reimbursement went up 4 cents per mile. So all those types of things I was able to absorb just from that one adjustment, bringing the base starting point of salaries down. However, when we start to look at this budget and address some of the issues brought up today and some other ones that we'll bring up as we review, this budget does, and I'm going to work from this document, the 2021 budget proposal document on the table. This budget does ask for a overall spending request of $79,781,000. This is a 14% increase over the 18 and 19 budget, or $10.1 million request in increased spending. However, I want to break that up into two different pieces. One, our operating budget would be increased by $7.3 million from 69 to 76 million. That's a 10% increase. And the one-time spending, looking at what we spend in one-time investments replacing end-of-life items, would be the balance of that increase, and that would be a $2.8 million increase compared to this biennium. So when you look at just the operating side, in 18 to 19, we had an operating budget of $69 million, but only an appropriation of 64.7. That's the deficit we're operating under. This proposal would look at creating equity between our operating budget and our appropriations and leaving the carry forward funds for those one-time replacement things, end-of-life duplicating machines, end-of-life servers, end-of-life IT equipment, our AED equipment is end-of-life, things like that, and we'll go through a list of that. Looking over time, just to give a little context, there is a chart in your packet showing appropriations and budgets approved over time. Looking back to the 2008-09 biennium through our current 18-19, you can see 10 years ago we had about a little over $63 million appropriation. At this point, we are about $1.3 million above that 10 years later. This would ask for an $11 million increase above that, but it equates to about that appropriation increase going back. What we're asking for today is about a 20% increase over the 8-9 biennium, or about a 3% increase per biennium over that time period. On the operating side, again, going from a 2008-9 to what we're asking for today, it's about a 24% increase over these 10 years, or about a 4% increase per biennium, or 2% per year. Regardless over that time period. With this budget that's being proposed, the other chart in your packet looks at carry forward. When all is said and done with this budget and these estimates, we would have an estimated $4.2 million left in the carry forward. You can see over time, back 08 through about 15, that's about the balance we carried. The significance of that number is twofold. One, it allows for about a two-month summer operating burn rate. In the summer, we spend about $2.2 million per month on various operating costs. This would allow in a shutdown to operate over a two-month period. It would also cover any liabilities for severance if the shutdown led to layoff situations. And so keeping that number there, is the $4 million is about where we're pinning the money to.
So, Ms. Juluk, we are at time. Yep. Another committee is coming in. Members, I just would like to leave you with a couple of points. So if you look at this chart showing the carry forward numbers, the decline that we're seeing is as a result of legislative pay increasing. So we are quickly burning through carry forward that accumulated to a very high level of $11 million. We are now burning through that every year if we stay at the same appropriation level, and that's why we will go out of business in 2022. And so we have to adjust that, and returning the carry forward to around $4 million is kind of the historic average from earlier in the last decade, and is as not because we anticipate a shutdown or a line item veto of the legislative budget, but because these things have happened And so I think it would be irresponsible for us to not have any kind of carry forward to prepare for the political disasters that we have seen in recent years. So I just feel that's a basic matter of responsibility. And on this chart, the appropriation, you'll see the red bar goes well above the appropriation, and that is, again, member salary increases. So we have a crisis that is needs to be resolved. And so we wanted to talk about staff compensation as part of that issue. But at a high level, the House budget has to be addressed this biennium, or we are going to be in big trouble. So, Representative Baker.
And just a quick question, Mr. Chair. When we had that that temporary issue with the governor vetoing or shutting down this branch for a little bit, were the carry-forward funds used for keeping us afloat? Has that been transferred? Was that part of this filling the gap here? So that has that been replaced? And is this? I want to make sure that these losses are not reflective of some that one-time event that happened.
Ms. Julek.
Mr. Chair, a couple things happened. One, carry forward was used, but I believe also we had transferred money from the LCC and borrowed money to operate from them, and that has all been paid back.
Okay.
So what you see on here are spending for 18 and 19 into the carry forward is our carry forward for our needs, and that is primarily the members' increase.
Thank you. And members, we'll have an opportunity to go through issues like old duplicating machines and servers and things that are generally wearing out at the end of life. And so we'll finish this up at another time to be determined to look through the total rest of this budget. We are adjourned.